This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. Elon Musk isn't the only one into interplanetary discovery. John Morrissey has taken us from Earth and has humans living on a different planet. But for what purpose? His book is called Bird Deity, and it is very, very clever. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Your book is told in parts, and it's not until part four that we learn about the bird deity, a bird of creation, mother of the universe. This deity has been worshipped as an idol or a divine being, but now there are only non-humans living on this planet. These are called ashes, or parasites. What are they? Can you give us a brief description?
So I suppose they're sort of the indigenous species to the planet where the novel's set. And I suppose throughout the book you kind of find out what happened to their civilization, which used to be very advanced, but by the time human beings arrive, they've kind of fallen to this sort of almost fugue state where they have no memory of their former lives, sort of like wander from place to place in this kind of, sort of amnesia. Yeah.
And the living conditions for the humans living here. Tell us about the weather.
It's a very rainy planet, kind of rains constantly. I just love that kind of a landscape. I love like a kind of wet sort of
Boggy wet. It's muddy wet. It's just continually wet.
Yeah, it was hard writing it, constantly trying to think of different ways to describe the rain. That was kind of difficult and a bit depressing after a while, but I thought it was important for the atmosphere of the book, so yeah.
Every 5 years, the Vogel-Frank Cartel Company flies in a frigate. The company executives are on a return flight. There's limited seats for others who have to fulfil a 5-year contract. Those that stay, there are the townies, the loggers, or the scouts employed by the Association of Chartered Geographers. All this costs means that they're making a profit. So what's the plateau? And what's of interest to them?
So I suppose the protagonist of the novel is named David, and he's one of the scouts. And essentially, they come over on one of these kind of indentured servitude contracts, and their role is to go up to the plateau where the parasapes live, essentially to recover artifacts from the parasape civilization. And they don't have any real understanding what these artifacts do, but they do have a dangerous effect on the human mind. So they have to take kind of precautions to protect themselves from the radiation of them. And essentially, it's kind of revealed, in the book that these...
We might get onto that later. So, as I said, it's a book divided into parts with different characters being taught to us, or shown to us, read, invented by you for us. And David is the connection. The first two parts are by women that David encounters, and they're both mothers. The first is Eliza, a botanist, and David was delighted with her curiosity. He... or another scout, Tom, could be the father. But motherhood has changed Eliza. She's now concerned about what they do. This is a quote. "I used to think, as scouts, you were both impressive, but now it makes me sick thinking of how you are hurting and robbing the ashes." So let's just think about that. There was a description of just the ashes. How do they wear these artifacts?
So essentially they're pieces of kind of jewellery or bracelets, breastplates, that kind of thing. And this is the only kind of clothing they wear. And they're very attached to them. And they're the only things in the world they seem to care about. So essentially to kind of take these artifacts off them, the scouts often use violence, even though the ashes never defend themselves.
Because they're part of their skin. Their skin's congealed over these. That's Eliza the botanist. Part two, we have Sarah, an anthropologist. She's flown in with her trip being paid for by a philanthropist, and a quote, "He's very rich, a trillionaire. He sells armaments, bombs, defence systems, but he also sponsors scientific expeditions in out-of-the-way places." What does she already know about these non-humans?
So essentially she's come... to sort of research this society on a kind of philanthropic exercise. And the ultimate goal is to have them declared as a protected species, which obviously would bring her into conflict with the scouts because that would essentially put an end to their kind of business model. So really there's this kind of conflict between sort of these kind of very abstract powers who don't feature directly in the novel, between the corporation, Vogel-Frank, and also this kind of mysterious philanthropist.
Yeah. She knows they're not aggressive and they don't reproduce, so every death is a genocide. Now, the scout that she chooses to take her up to the plateau must promise secrecy and not make any collections. But for the scout, if he's found out, he's going to be expelled from the association and would forfeit all the money he held on trust for him. But that amount is so small in what Sarah is offering him. Now, we're going to ask John to read from page 86, and it's going to be a bit tricky because he's got to put Sarah's voice on as well as David's.
So this is a conversation between David and Sarah as they're preparing to go up on this expedition. "I can probably get most of what I need," he said reluctantly. "Even a rifle. I have a friend I can talk to about that." "You don't need a gun," she said. "Why would you possibly need a gun?" "For defense," he answered. "It's known," she said, "that the Paris apes never show any form of hostility or aggression to human beings. It's why you scouts are so successful." "It's different," he said, "when you're up there." "What do you mean?" "You don't want to take any chances. They crowd you sometimes. They take an interest in you. It's like they're trying to figure out why you're there." "You're there to rob them," she replied. "I think they realize that on some level. It's hard to say."
So you can get that sense of foreboding about them. Now, we do get another part that has two people from a previous society, and they're talking about just buying these at a market, these little artifacts and stuff, and about how there's a necessity to read the stars and tell when a pilgrimage is going to happen. But it's Sarah, coming back to Sarah, the anthropologist. She explains to David that the going theory is the artifacts preserve memory. Their technology to do this is lethal to human beings. It's called pathic radiation. So a little bit more from page 106, The Bird Deity.
So this is a further conversation between Sarah and David. So David asks, "Why do VF, that's Vogel Frank, the company, want the devices then?" "The technology is priceless if it could be replicated for human use. If you could package and sell memory like that, anyone could experience a life of unimaginable pleasure or excitement. Everyone would be able to feel themselves equal in a way. I'm not sure if you remember just how bored people are getting back home. It's becoming a serious political problem." "But," she finished, "VF don't seem to be having much luck. Whatever the Parasapes did to make those devices all those hundreds of thousands of years ago, it's beyond our capabilities."
I just like that line about boredom and what's happening with boredom and the current situation here, causing political divide. So money might be able to fix it, or new memories. Oh dear. So she also explains what she thinks of the society and how it might have gone through decline. But so there's a race against time for David to get back to the frigate because his contract's up and there are dangers. Not so much from the parasites up there. Who from?
I think ultimately he's kind of forced to confront his own decisions, and I think that's ultimately his kind of trajectory as a character, is he's made selfish decisions and he's kind of forced to reckon with the consequences of his own selfishness. I think that's ultimately the sort of danger he faces. It's very much a kind of someone being forced to actually confront the kind of person they've become when they've deliberately tried to avoid reflecting on their own personality, their own actions.
He does reflect on his own mother. This is a quote. "He could not remember her face or the sound of her voice, but he did remember her hands, which had been large and strong, and the lingering warmth of her arms and her sense of sadness." So here's a mother, and this is sometimes the idea that comes back to him. Now, you gave us two small little illustrations in the book. You talked about one of these parasites, one of these coming down out of the plateau and rummaging through the garbage. And that was a very interesting bit. And then you compared it to, in the town, there were two kids rummaging through garbage. Oh, John Morrissey, what are you saying here?
I mean, I suppose in terms of the kind of colonial society, I think I've always been fascinated by science fiction, particularly that depicts sort of how kind of society adapts itself to its kind of environment. Like someone like J.G. Ballard's very, very good at depicting sort of the kind of abnormal societies that can emerge in sort of abnormal situations. And I suppose with the depiction of the colonial society, I wanted to kind of depict a society where everyone's purely motivated by self-interest and individualism and kind of the kinds of people that produces and how the society ultimately becomes sort of deformed as a result.
Dehumanized?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then that kind of, that, you know, translates into the violence which they direct outwards against the kind of indigenous species of the planet. It's all kind of a, it's all kind of a reflection of the same phenomenon.
Yeah. How do you sleep at night?
Well, I've got a young child, so pretty easily now when he's, if he doesn't wake me up. So, yeah.
Well, how do you find time to write? Because this is a very innovative book.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on it for a few years. There were a few false starts on it. It took me a while to kind of find the atmosphere I wanted and particularly to sort of get an angle on David as a protagonist. I mean, at first, the way I envisioned him was as a much more sort of completely unsympathetic character, like a pretty kind of hateful kind of person. And I realised that wasn't going to be a good book to write. So I wanted to create someone who had a bit more sort of, you can sort of empathise with him or understand where he comes from or why he turned out to be the way he has, yeah.
This place, it's so dull. It is dull in every aspect. But you actually bring in bits of colour, and it's with jacarandas. They're mentioned twice. What's your affinity with jacarandas?
Yeah, I suppose when I was writing it, when you're writing a science fiction novel, I found it a very delicate operation not to give too much information about the universe because I didn't want to write like a space opera or like really explain too much about what had happened over the last few hundred years or even something as simple as the way people talk. You know, I mean, language changes so much over years that the way people talk in a few hundred years will probably be unrecognizable to us. So I was very careful not to give too much detail because I didn't want to kind of get involved in those kind of issues. But also I did want to give a sense that, you know, this is fundamentally based on the real world and I wanted to give a sense that the main character wasn't Australian. So that was kind of important to how I imagined him. And so I thought having jacaranda trees was a good way to kind of just have that moment of just sort of local colour, yeah. Yeah.
And you call the ship that they come down in is a frigate. And, you know, to me, it's, of course, a ship. And it's how quite often it's a smaller ship that a lot of migrants arrive in. Mm. Is the choice why it was called a frigate?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I just like the word frigate. It's always been a kind of favourite word of mine for some reason. I don't know why I just like the word.
There are so many great words in this book. You know, I was out there with my dictionary a lot checking them out. So you have been keen on words. You could tell in this book. Well, look, you can tell I enjoyed it. A scout on another planet makes money from plundering the ruins of an alien civilization, but finds himself questioning every choice he has made in John Morrissey's book, Bird Deity. Oh, John, a ripper of a read. Thank you.
Thank you.
My book today goes into a word, and one word in particular, furphy. The Furphy Literary Award is a brilliant Australian blend of history, language, culture and family. And I have with me today two authors whose work appears in the sixth anthology. Put my teeth in, try that again. That stems from that award. So Emma Westwood and Damien O'Donnell. So Emma, Damien, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you very much.
Now, the first thing I want to do is unravel the Furphy Award. I mean, Emma, what does it represent to you and what made you enter?
Well, interestingly, and this sounds like that you know, I had some sort of advantage. It wasn't, because it's an anonymous award, the way it's actually judged. So our manuscripts don't have their our names on them. But I knew of one of the judges. I knew one of the judges, John Harms, who runs the Footy Almanac, which is an online community, sporting community, of which Damien Dips O'Donnell beside me is involved in as well. And he was spruiking it, saying, and I've heard him talk about it over a number of years, and I thought, this is a great way to really give me a kickstart back into fiction writing, because I hadn't been writing fiction for a long time. And it's just, yeah, just a great way to motivate you and get you, you know, off your bum.
And Damien, what do you think the significance is then of the Furphy Literary Competition?
Oh, what I liked about it is that it gives any mug like me a chance. I mean, it's
sounds very Australian, you know.
Like Emma, I know John. Met John many years ago, and he's a great encourager and renowned writer in his own right. And he, via the Footy Almanac, was saying, "Look, just keep posting stuff, because the only way to get good at writing is to write."
Yeah. But what I love about it, Furphy, it's a word.
Yeah, I know.
But it's also a family.
Yeah.
What do you know the background?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Joseph Furphy wrote Such Is Life. His brother, I'm sure, was the one who started the business they have.
And it's still going.
And it's still going, and the family's still involved.
Yeah, they're providing sort of infrastructure support, which they did, and so they had water carriers back in Australia's early past, around which people would congregate and tell stories, which gave rise to the word, well, that's a bit of a furphy. Furphy meaning story. So we've got language, we've got the history of Australia, we've got a family culture. And they've not reclaimed it, they've always had it and are promoting it. So this is an ongoing ferment of family history, Australianness that's still going on today, which I think is absolutely fantastic. But this means we need to get onto your particular contributions to this anthology. There are quite a number of stories. But both of you seem to be touching on the macabre a little with your entries, with a little bit of comical insight, may I add. Damien, the Grim Gripper. The end of the world is nigh. We sound like we're getting into John's territory here. What are Barry Craig, Tom O'Malley, and Cockeye doing, mate? Come on, give us an outline.
Well, I'm a bit interested in the absurd. I think life is pretty absurd. Like we're born, we're completely reliant. We acquire these great skills like reading and writing and maths, and some of us even get some wisdom, and then we die. So I just think the whole thing's completely absurd. So I was a bit interested in writing a story that had a large element of absurdity, and it seemed to me a whole lot of people in a pub watching the world end, what would they be talking about? That's sort of the genesis of the story.
Well, yeah, heat and cold are sort of thrown against each other in this end of the world, prompted perhaps by current environmental issues, or is that just your imagination gone wild?
Yeah, not really. It's probably the imagination. I mean, if the end of the world's coming, it may as well start with the sun imploding. So that was where that came from. And if the sun's not there, it's in and out, it's going to get very cold. So it was really more practical than anything else.
And there is a hand caught on the doorknob. How did that come? Which is where the story gets its title.
Yeah, I have no idea. The idea of a fella going to the pub and the door's locked and the big freeze has started and the people inside are alive because they've got a fire, and he tries to get in, grabs the doorknob and freezes to death. It just appealed to me as sort of something completely, well, absurd.
Yes. So. But the interesting thing is that grip, that hand, endures longer than Barry Craig, Tom O'Malley, and Cockeye.
Yes.
Because all of a sudden you project your story 2,000 years into the future. So we have Zorlak and Krunk.
Krunk here. Yeah.
What are they doing?
Yeah, wonderful names. Zordak and Krunk are, well, the idea was to create people in the future who are as big idiots as we are now.
Nothing's going to change, in other words.
But Zordak is a bit interested in history, and hence he's interested in this hand that they found, the Gripper. His hand was protected because a porcelain bowl fell on it and he survived the Great Fire, or the hand survived the Great Fire. So he's a bit interested in history, but Krunk is the bureaucrat and he just wants to make money out of this invention. I won't go into that, but, yeah, it was sort of I wanted to create a paradox between the two of them.
But also then, you know, you've got an event like that porcelain bowl, which was completely accidental, yes, and we're trying to make sense of something we've discovered. It's but like archaeologists today, how do we explain the past when there's no other record and you're looking at the bare bones of it, trying to rationalise about what's going on? But are there any limits then to short stories, given what you've done? I mean, you've got it grounded in a reality of blokes in a pub, which everyone can identify with, but then you break all sorts of boundaries.
All the rules. That's what I like about the short story and the Furphy short story. It's Australianness is the theme, but that's pretty broad. And I just like the idea that a short story, you can just go nuts. You can go wherever you want. And your imagination is the only thing holding you back, so long as it's not completely crazy, I guess. Whereas, and I haven't written a novel, so I don't really know what I'm talking about, but it strikes me that a novel is probably got to be more structured and more less lunacy involved, perhaps. I'm not sure.
But Emma, the undying love of specimen A398 is the title of your story. But we also start off in a pub. What is it about Australians and pubs?
I know, and I have to say that I didn't know that Damien was putting in a short story in this competition. He didn't know I was. So these are completely mutually exclusive of each other. We weren't in, you know, cahoots or anything. But I do think that there is something unique about pub culture in Australia, even, you know, comes from the UK culture really, but it's still different here. And for me, I was kind of intrigued by those characters, like this idea of community at a pub, which Damien has in his as well. But this idea of, you know, you see the ones that are a bit more open and talkative, and then you see the quiet souls who come in and hardly ever talk and just sit there.
But a range of characters. In fact, your story opens with a character, unusually so, Barry is a corpse
in a previous dead.
In a previous life, Barry, aka Baz, Bazza, Sparky, shit for brains, etc., etc., choked on a fried chip at the local pub. Mm-hmm. Now you can't get anything more banal and ordinary than that.
Yeah,
delightful.
Yeah. I describe the story as someone who is more important in death than they were in life.
And then you extend from there, because in death he finds love. Is this?
Yeah.
Am I reading it correctly?
Yeah, while he's decomposing.
How is this possible?
Quite contradictory.
How is this possible? Yeah. Explain yourself.
Yeah, well, he gets donated to science, basically, his body, and he finds himself in a body farm, and it's a concept that I don't know whether a lot of people know about, but I read about it, and I particularly read about one that was in, where I say, the Blue Mountains. It's an unnamed facility. Mm. And what they do is basically bury bodies or have bodies in various stages of decomposition to study them and analyze them. And a lot of the times for crime purposes, for identifying, yeah.
Well, so also for medical purposes.
And medical purposes, I mean,
you can donate your body to Melbourne University or whatever the anatomy department to be cut up for teaching purposes.
Yep.
So you're not actually redundant when you're dead. You can be put to good use.
No, Barry became very useful.
But how would you describe the nature of the love that's taking place here?
Oh, because this is a character who he hasn't had much attention through life. He's managed to sort of slip through the cracks a little bit. So having the attention of a young female scientist who is obviously very attentive to him, you know, is something that he's not used to. And he likes that attention despite the fact that he's not conscious. So that was quite a challenge to write that and have tenses correct and things like that.
Mm. Yeah. As Barry decomposes, the relationship with his blonde sweetheart blossoms.
And so, the decomposition was interesting too.
But you raise an interesting point then of grammar. I mean, even the banal things like grammar still come to the fore when you're writing something that's so creative. We've still got to follow certain rules, but we can break boundaries in other ways. But let's get into both of you. Who writes short stories? What sort of mindset do you have to have? Damien, you're a tax accountant by trade. What the hell are you doing writing short stories?
Well, accountants tell stories every day. It's called financial statements. They're total fiction. But
this is a great ad for your business.
cooking the books. No, what got you into it?
Oh, I've been very lucky. Growing up, I had uncles on both sides of the family who were writers. One was an historian. They both were sort of historians in their own way. And they were interesting people. And so I was always interested in writing, I guess, from that point of view. But it really took off, excuse me, when I met John Harms, going back to that, and the Footy Almanac, and was encouraged to keep writing. And then ideas pop into your head. And Yeah, oftentimes I'll start writing a short story and it'll end up nowhere where I thought it would end up. And I just find that fun, actually.
Great. But Emma.
Yes.
Cinema. Yes. Is your forte. You have non-fiction books on things like The Fly.
And, you know, which, talk you about know, decomposition.
Decomposition and macabre cinema.
Yeah, I do. I like provocative cinema and I like horror cinema because I think you can explore everyday things in a really interesting way, with heightened creativity when you apply it through a horror lens.
Do you think that has influenced this story?
I'd say so, yeah. Yeah, it have to. I wouldn't call this a horror story. It's a bit more of a comedic story, really. But I have to say that watching a lot of horror films has definitely influenced me.
Influenced your audience. But John, your first book was a collection of short stories, wasn't it? How long ago was that?
It was back in 2022, I think it came out.
2022. Yeah. Did I interview you about that? I think can't remember.
What were they about? It was a book of short stories. So there were two kind of longer stories, almost novella length. But they're all science fiction horror kind of theme stories.
Science fiction horror. Yeah. We seem to have a connection here between our authors.
I think we're all linked in some way. The two science fiction tales as well, like listening to John.
Yes, and words and things like that. It was all interconnecting. There's a strange synergy that sometimes takes place in this studio. But one step further then, the Furphy Literary Award. It is again open for 2026. I mean, how do people get onto it? How do you enter?
Well, it's the website. So there's, can't remember the address. Can you remember?
But it's
just a Furphy. If you Google Furphy, you'll find. Well, if you Google Furphy Literary Award,
you'll get there.
Find it.
And it's a case of there's a submit button, and obviously you've got to have certain font size and all that sort of stuff. But it's not hard. It's very easy to submit.
Yeah, and it's also the shortest story will be 2,000 words, which is mine, and the longest story has 5,000 words.
5,000,
so that's the word limit.
Yeah, and which was interestingly enough, it's free to enter.
It is free.
Whereas a lot of other short story competitions, you've got to pay, you know, $20 or whatever.
Also, it's got a big first prize. It's a very generous
$15,000. So Google it, folks. Enter. I can't overstate the significance and importance of what is a homegrown product, what is Australian. Are you going to say something
else? Yeah, I just wanted to say Damien and I didn't win one of the first, second, third awards, but as part of the shortlist, you get to be in this Furphy anthology. So you actually get published.
In some ways, dare I say, $15,000 would be nice, but it's not about the prize.
No, it's not.
It's
not at all.
What they're doing is fostering Australian writing. Mm. And with the closure of things like Meanjin and such like, we need more of this.
Yeah.
And I love it that the Furphy family have taken ownership of their history and the heritage and sort of continued it and fostered it.
And create a book from it, which is fabulous.
And there's 6 years of books now.
Yes, you can join in.
Yeah. And Jan, what were you going to... Sorry,
well, I was just going to wind up. Finish up by saying and reminding people that I was chatting with John Morrissey in his book, The Bird Diet, he published by Text.
And I had been talking to Damien O'Donnell and Emma Westwood, and it's a Hardy Grant publication, which I think you can get online as well, the Furphy Anthology, but you can look into the back catalogue as well. Yep. You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.